Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, marking the 75th anniversary of Executive Order 9066 this weekend, with an American veteran of Japanese descent who avoided incarceration in the infamous internment camps that held more than 120,000 prisoners. Sam Terasaki of Denver, Colorado, led a mortar squad in Company A of the 100th Infantry Battalion. By the time he got overseas, that was a part of the 442nd Regimental Combat Team, the most decorated American unit of its size in all of World War II.
I can tell this is not something that stirs a lot of surface visible emotions for you. I mean, you're describing this for me in a very matter-of-fact way. But I'm thinking about a young man who's going to go overseas knowing that guys who've gone before him have gotten killed and that you might get killed.
Yeah.
How'd you feel about that?
Well, you do what you're supposed to do. I wondered why it was me and not the guy next to me that got wounded or killed. I was fortunate that I got through the war without a scratch. In retrospect, I think being classified 4C may have saved my life because I would have been drafted right away and would have been ended up in the 442nd very early on and shipped overseas when the regiment went overseas. As it was, by the time I joined as a replacement, I had missed one of the big battles, the rescue of the Lost Battalion and the capture of these two French towns, Biefontaine and Bruyères.
And that's the signature achievement of the 442, or the one that gets the most publicity, because there were more members of the 442nd Regimental Combat Team killed and wounded than there were mostly Caucasian soldiers from that Lost Battalion rescued.
Yeah. Some of the fellows that when I joined up, they had just pulled back from the front lines, and one of the fellows whose brother I had taken basic training with, we looked him up, and sure enough, he was in the medics, and you could see in his eyes the hell that he'd gone through because I had seen him in Camp Shelby before they shipped out as a replacement themselves. He was in the group of replacements just before me.
So when you saw him over there, you saw a different look in his eye?
Oh, absolutely. You could see that. You could tell that he was through hell.
What was your first taste of combat and what this is really going to be like?
Well, at that time, it was after they'd pulled back from the front lines, and we were so depleted in manpower that they gave us easy duty in southern France. That was from November until the next spring in March of 45. Yeah, all the time our particular company were in the Maritime Alps, I guess is what they called it. It was right on the border of Italy and France.
Right.
And being in a weapons platoon, my job each night was to go up to the outpost on the border and look down into Italy and man a machine gun just in case the Germans came, tried to attack there. Although I was a mortar man by, what do they call it, MOS or something like that.
Uh-huh.
And then when dawn would break, well, then we'd get out of that machine gun nest and come back down the mountain to the backside, into the French side, because they knew that there was a machine gun nest there. In fact, the German artillery had a direct hit on it one day when we were out of the...
So the very position that you occupied the night before or the night after got hit?
It was in
the
daytime.
Day.
Generally, the Germans wouldn't shoot their artillery at night because it would reveal their position very precisely, where in the daytime they would shell us. And when we went up the next night, we saw the destruction. And it actually was a direct hit.
Wow.
We had a spare 30 caliber machine gun barrel there, and you hold it up and look through it, and you could see a dent on the inside where a shrapnel hit.
That's a pretty direct hit.
Pretty direct hit.
Does that get your attention a little bit?
Yeah, a little bit.
And to do that night after night, you know, in the dark, not knowing what's out there, not knowing if you're going to have to fire that weapon or not, does that tense, nerve-wracking?
No, it wasn't. The only time I got tense is when the old-timers used to scare the hell out of us replacements, you know, because we had a whole string of outposts besides a machine gun nest. They had dugouts all along, I don't know how many, couple miles maybe, mm-hmm. just my company. And they would say, oh, just to scare the hell out of us, I guess. Oh, I heard something there, and actually they didn't, uh-huh. but they'd say the Tedeschi's are coming. And
they pulled it over on you a few times before you figured it out. Huh?
And those guys would send out a patrol every so often, five-man, seven-man patrol, just to see if the Germans were up to anything. In the meantime, from November until March, the replacements kept coming over, more and more replacements, to fill the depleted ranks.
Right. There were so many casualties, there were a lot to replace.
That's right. Then when we were considered full strength, well, that's when we shipped back to Italy. Didn't know it at that time, but when we came home with the regimental colors and had the honor of marching for President Truman, at that time it was Secretary of War Stimson, I believe, that told us that we were a unique outfit in that we were not under the jurisdiction of any one army or any one general or anything. They all had to go through the War Department. The 100th Battalion in Italy. He didn't want to give them up, but Truscott in France wanted them from the invasion of southern France and for the battle into Germany. Clark lost out. The regiment, including the 100th Battalion, was sent to France. That's when they got involved, not only in the invasion of southern France, some of the units flew into southern France on gliders.
Yeah.
Where they happened to end up rescuing the remnants of the regiment that was encircled. They were getting ready for the last offensive against the Germans, so Clark wanted the regiment back in Italy. So that's why we went from Italy to France and back to Italy, all the time in combat.
And I want to hear about what you experienced in Italy, but you just gave us an overview of the things that happened before you got there. And by the time you got there, this moniker, Go for Broke, I'm sure was well established. Is that something that you heard when you joined the unit?
Heard it more on the crap table than...
uh-huh. Well, that's where it originated, right?
That absolutely is a Hawaiian slang for all or nothing. And the guys would be rolling dice on the army blanket and say, okay, and he's down to his last chips. I'll go for broke. Yeah.
What did that mean to you? I mean, if you have to explain that to someone who's never even heard that term and they say, well, why was 442 known as the Go for Broke unit?
Well, then just explain to them. That's a Hawaiian term for all or nothing.
Well, and what did all or nothing mean for you and those guys in uniform?
That never entered my mind.
All right. So the way you're describing it, your first 4 or 5 months over there were fairly uneventful.
Absolutely. While we were exposed and some guys were wounded or killed, very few. You could count them on less than 10 fingers, although we were shelled just once in a while. We got our supplies, rations, and things by mule train. Our battalion headquarters was in a resort city on the Riviera, a place called Menton, which was east of the big city of Nice. Well, that's where we went for rest and recuperation. And I remember getting my first break after going overseas and joining the outfit. It took us almost all day to get down to the battalion headquarters, and I was a little grimy. I don't think I'd had a bath or a shower for over, say, 5 weeks. So it's pretty ripe.
Why do I have the feeling that there were some eye-opening moments for you when you got to Italy?
Well, when we got to Italy, they gave us all new rifles and mortars and stuff. We did a little practicing. I guess one of the highlights was the fact that General Clark came up in a jeep to address the 100th Battalion, and knowing that we were going to go into battle, and the Battle of the Gothic Line, wished us well and welcomed us back to Italy and so forth. It was day after or so that night, I'm not sure which, and we pushed off and were hauled in the big open bed trucks up to the front lines and then walked the rest of the way up the hill in the dark until we were committed to battle in the morning of April 5th.
Were you prepared for what you were going to experience?
No, because I hadn't experienced anything like that where you're throwing grenades at each other. And we set up our mortar in a foxhole that had been dug by American forces that were there ahead of us. My best Army buddy, who was from originally from Oxnard, California, who settled in Atlanta, Georgia, Mike Doy, he and I were in the mortar squad that I was in charge of, set up our mortar, and while up above us, the guys in the rifle platoons were fighting.
So you're seeing things and hearing things and probably smelling things and experiencing things that you've never experienced before.
Well, the foxhole was dug in a position where there was a huge rock on our left side, up against a huge rock. A rifle grenade or potato masher, I think it was a rifle grenade, came down and luckily hit on the opposite side of that rock.
So bang. Only a few feet from you, maybe 10 feet or something?
No, inches.
But the rock was in between you and the impact.
Yeah.
So if the rock's not there,
we're gone. We're gone. One of the, I don't know whether he was an officer or not, but he was in the outfit that was there before we replaced them, came down the trail. It was a narrow, very narrow trail. He's kind of chuckling. I think he was happy that he's going to go to the rear echelon. He says, those guys are up there throwing grenades at each other. Well, that's what happened. In fact, the one Medal of Honor that was bestowed during the war was Spud Munimori, who was in our company, A Company. In fact, I'd just talked to him an hour before when the rifle platoon was cutting through our line to get ahead of us, and I just happened to see him, and I said, okay, well, take it easy, Spud. And it was still dark, and that was the last I saw him. He was killed, saving the life of two of his squad members by jumping on the grenade before it exploded. Took his own life, saved their lives.
I can tell in your eyes and in your voice that he's someone you admire and respect.
Absolutely. And it's something that I never talked about for maybe 50 years after the fact, I guess. I don't know how many years it was, but I just couldn't talk about it without crying. It was my family. We had a dinner at home, and I don't know how the subject came up, but I started crying. I guess somebody wanted to know about the war, and I had to excuse myself. And I find that the more you talk about it, the easier it is to do it without getting so emotional. But some things that, horrible things, that, you know, we had, I think, five guys in our company alone that had their foot blown off that morning of the 5th of April.
Your first day in combat.
Yeah, and they had their foot blown off, and the litter bearers, like I say, the trail up to the front lines was so narrow that they had to come by our gun emplacement. And
so you're seeing them come by one after one after the other.
Yeah.
And wondering when you're going to be.
Well, I remember two in particular. One, I didn't know him, but he was a rifleman, I'm sure, had stepped on a mine, and the litter bearers were taking him back to the first aid station, and he kept saying, itai, itai, which in Japanese means it hurts, it hurts. What was left of his foot, they put back on the litter because it had fallen off the side. It was hanging there by the skin. Another fellow that I remember was Lieutenant Novak, who was a platoon leader, and had his foot blown off. Oh, he was, even though they, I know they, medics must have given him a shot of morphine. He was still in pain. You could hear him moaning all the way down the mountain as they carried him down to the aid station. Novak eventually became an MD, lost his foot, of course. And during one of our reunions, here's this rabbi that showed up at one of our reunions, and it turns out he was Lieutenant Novak's son, and he wanted to know if there were any guys around at the reunion that knew his dad. And there were a couple.
And there were a couple non-Japanese American members of these units. And some people don't realize that. They hear 100th Battalion or 442, and they assume every single member was Japanese American. How did you guys interact with those who weren't Japanese American?
Well, it was easy for me because I grew up in an all-Caucasian community, very few Japanese. Actually, it was kind of a cultural thing for me. For instance, I grew up with eating half the time Japanese meals, half the time American meals, meat and potatoes.
Mm-hmm.
But when we were in basic training and when we were overseas, we ate as much rice as we could get our hands on. Trade our chocolate candy and cigarettes for rice when we were in Italy. Came home and always wanted rice. And my mother told my wife, my future wife, she says, I thought Sam was in the wrong army. He wanted rice all the time.
She thought you were wearing the rising sun, huh?
No, his uniform was American. His flag was red, white, and blue. And his blood was every bit as red as any other American serviceman. We're not done just yet with 92-year-old Sam Tarasaki. When we come back, we'll learn how a man once classified as an enemy alien ended up as a guest of honor outside the White House. Then 6 decades later, in the halls of Congress, Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.